Please take your seats. We are starting a session. And I really encourage you to take your seats because this is going to be a very exciting session. We have a very young scholar, Carlos Tagnaro.
Baby scholar!
Presenting his paper, Carlos Tagnaro. He's the director of IBM Observatory on Digital Markets. So he has a little bit to say about the innovation. And he will be followed by Maria Blanco, which is a professor of history of economic thought at the Universidad de San Jose, San Pablo. And so I will be strict about timing, and I will please ask you both to keep your presentation with a length of time. I know you're both law-abiding presenters, so that we can have so that we can have a fruitful discussion later. Carol?
Thank you very much. Of course, I'm 21 with 20 years of experience. In my presentation, I will try to answer a big question, which is, why do regulation exist? The real question I will try to address is, why do some regulation exist, and how it can be understood and predicted which kinds of regulation will be introduced within a jurisdiction. To answer that question, I will first recall briefly the main theories of economic regulation. Then I will move upon one particular theory, which is known as Baptist and Newlegers. And finally, I will try to apply this theory to what is happening with the digital economy, and to leverage on my own experience as a member in the Valley of the Beast, where I spent about 4 years of my life in between 2014 and 2018 working in the Italian Ministry of Economic Development, where I could actually see regulations being introduced or regulations being repealed or regulations being proposed and discussed. And then I will conclude and summarize and leave the floor to Maria for a discussion. So, first point. Usually, given an existing framework of regulation, new regulation is very often introduced or at least proposed and discussed when some change happens in the society or in the economy. And this change may be technological changes, like with the digitalization of productive processes. It can be demographic changes, which is what happens, for example, with migrations. It may be significant changes in factor costs that may be due to technological innovation or to some new productive input being developed. Or the change may come along with new information being produced. As we will see, when we talk about digitalization and the digital economy, all of these changes, or at least most of these changes, are happening together at the same time. Based on these changes happening in society, policymakers may introduce regulatory reforms that may result in distributive or allocative effects. Whenever this happens, someone within society will win, others will lose, and social welfare, which is, I understand, an ambiguous concept, but please take it at face value for the sake of the presentation, social welfare may or may not be enhanced. As I said, the point I'd like to address is what explains and what predicts the actual decisions that are being made. To do that, I will go very briefly through the main theories of regulation. When you speak about economic theories of regulation, there is a clear dividing line in the history of economic thought, which is before Chicago and after Chicago. Basically, before Chicago, which means before the 60s and the 70s of the last century, the there was no formalized theory of regulation. When I say theory of regulation, I mean theory of why regulation is introduced and how it is introduced. There was basically no formalized theory. There was rather an implicit assumption which was underlying all of the works of the classical and neoclassical economists, which we could call the public interest theory. The idea was that the government and people within the government, both elected officials and bureaucrats, were pursuing the general interest to the best of their knowledge. Very rarely there was the idea that, number one, policymakers may not possess all of the relevant information, and secondly, they might have different goals than the general interest, leave aside the definition of what the general interest is. This assumption, as I said, basically remained until the Chicago Revolution happened. And the Chicago Revolution happened, and the messiah was George Stigler when it comes to the theory of regulation. George Stigler, in 1971, published a very famous and seminal paper that, for the first time, introduced a different approach to the theory of regulation that we can call the capture theory. Stigler basically said the policymaker does not possess all the relevant information, he's not omniscient. And because of this, he has to rely on external advisors. Who is more likely to become an advisor of a policymaker? Well, there can be basically two possible answers. Answer number one is who, for some reason, possesses more knowledge about the issue being debated. And answer number two, those who have an interest in the proposed regulation. And very often, those who have an interest, of course, know have the knowledge about the proposed regulation and its effects and about the social changes I was mentioning in the beginning. According to the capture theory, even if the policymaker is completely well-intentioned and willing to pursue the general interest, he has to rely on external sources of knowledge, and these sources of knowledge may not be as much aimed at public interest. And this may result in the policymaker being captured by them. In the policymaker relying on partial information that will lead him or her to adopt wrong regulation, and by wrong I mean regulation that results in less innovation, less investments, less social progress, and so on and so forth. The capture theory provides us with a powerful instrument to understand what happens in the regulatory process, but it does not provide all of the answers. For example, it is of no help in saying us who will be more effective in capturing policymakers. After all, whenever a change happens in society, you have many actors who have an interest in proposing and getting new regulations introduced, but only some of them will succeed. So how do you know which ones will be effective and which ones will be successful? One measure of how much Stigler was a genius is that in the same paper where he formalized the capture theory, he also started to propose the next theory, which we can call private interest theory. According to this new approach, in order to understand which groups, which pressure groups, which lobbyists would be more effective in capturing policymakers, you have to look at the consequences of the economic consequences of the proposed regulation. In particular, a proposed regulation is more likely to be adopted if it will result in concentrated benefits. That is, there will be a target group who will enjoy the benefit of regulations and who is aware of this, and diffuse the costs. That is, the cost of the new regulation is spread all across the world, and most people who are paying the bill either do not realize they are taxed or they are suffering the consequences of regulation, or even if they do, the cost is so tiny that they have no practical incentive to take a stand against the proposed regulation. A fourth theory of regulation comes from Matt Chisney, from Fred McChisney, who formulated it in 1991, and that we can call money for nothing theory. According to the money for nothing theory, the policymaker is no longer well-intentioned. He or she may have very private interests, and so it is the policymaker who starts the debate by throwing into the public debate the regulation proposal. In this case, you will have some groups taking a stand in favor of it and other groups taking a stand against the proposed regulation. And so you will see that you will have the you will set in motion the capture plus concentrated benefits and reduced costs mechanism. And finally, the fifth theory of regulation is what was formulated for the first time by Clemson University economist Bruce Yandel in 1983, and then developed in several later papers, which he called the Baptists and Bootleggers. What question does the Baptist and Bootleggers theory try to answer? Basically, Yandel starts from Stigler and Feldman, so from the capture theory, and he says, okay, we know that capture plays a major role, and we know that when a regulation results in concentrated benefits and diffused costs, it is more likely to be adopted. But how can somebody who has an interest in getting a regulation approved make sure that the costs will be really diffused and that the new regulation will be socially acceptable? After all, the policymakers, he is willing to satisfy his constituents, he is willing to give something to his supporters, but not at the price of going against the social consensus. So Yandel tries to understand how social consensus can be built. And he proposes this theory, which is named after a real situation that was common, pretty much common, in the southern states of the United States in the early 20th century before prohibition. There you had basically two radically different groups lobbying and calling for the regulation of Sunday openings of liquor stores. One group was Baptists. Of course, Baptists wanted to shut down liquor stores on Sundays for religious reasons, because it's not good and nice that believers spend their Lord's Day by drinking alcohol. And then you had another group lobbying for Sunday closing laws, which were bootleggers. If you are a bootlegger, you are very happy if liquor stores will be shut down, because whoever wants to drink will have to come to yourself and pay a premium on the fact that you are selling liquor on Sunday. And so what happened in the US, in the southern US states, was that this very strange coalition was most successfully promoting their preferred regulation, because on one hand, you had bootleggers lobbying politicians behind the doors, and on the other hand, you had Baptists creating the social consensus and social acceptance and the moral high ground for the regulation to be introduced. Yandel argues that whenever you can form a Baptist and coalition, and bootleggers coalition, that is a coalition where we have somebody with a very high moral stand defending a regulation, and somebody else having a very clear interest in the regulation itself, then it is most likely that that regulation will be actually introduced. The modes of interaction between Baptists and bootleggers are various. Yandel identifies four different modes. Covert, when the bootleggers dress themselves in Baptist clothes. Non-cooperative, perspective, like in the real Baptist and clerics, there was no official or clear coordination among them, but they were moving independently in the same direction, cooperated when they consciously cooperate, and coordinated when, like in the money for nothing approach, it's a politician, it's a policymaker who basically set in motion all the movement. In the meantime, since 1983, several papers have been published in the literature that apply this theory to a number of cases like environmental regulation, foreign trade regulation, tobacco regulation, marijuana-related land use regulation, EU timber regulation, and other, where you can find the same pattern of Baptists and bootleggers. What all of these cases have in common is that the bootleggers are usually big business. It's the big business lobbying the government and cooperating either in a conscious or unconscious way with somebody in the Baptist party. What I'm going to argue in the second half of my speech is that with the digital revolution and the digital economy changing the way society is organized, you can still find the dynamics of Baptists and bootleggers, but it's very often, the bootleggers camp is occupied by, not by big business, but by smaller business operators who still ask and call for specific regulation to defend themselves and their organizational structure from the changes which are induced by the digitalization of the economy. I'm not going to spend too much time on what the digital economy is. What is relevant to me is to clearly state that I'm interested in the digital economy and I'm talking of the changes which are connected with the digitalization to the extent that the digital economy is instrumental to reduce transaction costs and therefore to make economically efficient organizational structures which are basically disintegrated as opposed to vertically or horizontally integrated structures which were common in the old economy, exactly because of high transaction costs. To illustrate what happens in the when Baptists and bootleggers mess up with the digital economy, I will make four examples from my own experience as an of economic development. And I will try to employ them to match with the four modes of interaction that we described. First mode was the covert mode of interaction, where the Baptist, the bootlegger dressed in Baptist clothes. And my own example is the so-called anti-Flixbus Amendment. How many of you are familiar with Flixbus and know what Flixbus is? Okay, but slightly more than half, which means I have to explain. Flixbus is basically an online platform which allows you to make a reservation on bus with several bus operators to get from one day to point B, basically anywhere in Europe. In order to do this, Flixbus does not directly operate buses, but it coordinates different partner companies in the various European countries. Who is the bootlegger in this case? Well, it is the traditional bus operators. There is a very nice interview in an Italian daily to the head of the business association of traditional bus operators, who said, "We policymakers need to take a stand against Flixbus because it is disrupting our model of business." And the question, the subsequent question was, in which sense they are disrupting your models of business? And he said, well, the problem is that prices are going too low. Of course, this was not the main argument of traditional bus operators. They made a number of initiatives to convince policymakers that Flixbus actually result that the model of business of Flixbus would actually result in the exploitation of workers in the partner companies. Except that workers in the partner companies to extent say, no, we are very happy that we want to work and we got a nice salary, and so please don't mess with us. In the next slide, I will tell you the outcome. The second example that I have is the Italian response to Baptists and bootleggers, and I might call it Catholic priests and small retailers. And it was, believe it or not, about Sunday closing laws, even though not just for liquor stores, but for anybody else. In this case, in 2012, Italy totally deregulated shop opening hours, which was a very nice thing for consumers and customers. But of course, there was some relatively less productive and smaller shops who did not like this change. And they got organized and started a lobbying activity against longer opening hours on one hand, but on the other hand, don't forget we are talking about the digital economy, against e-commerce, because e-commerce never closes even on Sundays. This case is very funny to me because, again, I can say that the bootleggers are small shops organizations, but the Baptists are actually Catholics, which religiously speaking is kind of a funny one. In this case, the interaction was non-cooperative in the sense that there was no, to my knowledge at least, there was no formal link between small shop organizations and the Catholic Church. My third example, and again, I will tell you how the story ends. My third example of cooperative mode of interaction is food delivery platforms. You will know that there are in Italy as well as in many other countries a number of platforms like Deliveroo, Foodora, Uber Eats, and others that allow you to order a lunch or a meal at basically any time of the day or the night from your favorite restaurant. This case is pretty much funny because apparently there is nobody on the other side, there is no business being disrupted by food delivery platforms, but the organizational structure of food delivery platforms is such that the riders are basically independent workers who choose when to work and when not to work and when to make themselves available and whether or not accepting a ride. This is very nice for the platforms, very nice for the riders themselves, who, when interviewed or called, say that the best thing of their job is flexibility. But this is not nice for trade unions, who are our bootleggers in this case. So trade unions started lobbying activity together with some riders' association, which represent a very tiny minority of actual riders. Asking for a law making basically illegal for online platforms to employ independent workers and to force them to take as employees the riders, which of course it's basically a nonsense given the kind of business they do. In my final mode of example, which is the coordinated mode of interaction, is a couple of examples of taxes on online transactions that were introduced in Italy last year. Here you have Baptists who are all of those campaigning against the presumed tax evasion of online operators. You have bootleggers, which are basically offline businesses who see their margins and volumes being displaced by online competition. But the mode of interaction in this case was coordinated in the sense that everything started from two very relevant policymakers in the 2013-2018 term of the Italian Parliament, who were the chairman of the Industry Committee of the Senate and the Productive Activity Committee in the Chamber. They started the show and they created all the whatever follows. How did it go, and what was the position of the government in that moment? I will very, very quickly recall this because I think I have less than 5 minutes. I mean, already be out of time.
Three minutes.
Okay, in the anti-police amendment, the government opinion was against. Actually, there was a debate inside the government because, you've got the traditional bus operators, they vote and they support. Donate money to political parties, but the public opinion was clearly against the regulatory change. In a way, the bootleggers tried to dress in fascist clothes, but the clothes were not really credible. And so the outcome was basically that the regulatory change was repealed, even though the committee was created to study the issue, which in the Italian political language means that the amendment was appealed, but at the same time the committee is still there, so there is a chance that somebody, sometime will go back to this issue and will start to re-propose again the this kind of regulation. When something was involved, which extend to some extent, and I don't know actually why, I can't understand how that would be possible, but anyway, to online operators, the government was, as long as we had the former government led by Renzi and Gentiloni, the government was silently against the change. I mean, the government was, if you talk with anybody from within the government, they said it would be crazy to do this, but nobody said that before the microphone. Anyway, the silent opposition of the government allowed for the reform not to be approved, but the new government is explicitly in favor of the regulation, which is being debated right now. In the parliament, so we will see whether that is a good legacy, or to be more precise, the abortion owners and the Catholic Church will win the battle, or will common sense will eventually prevail. Food delivery regulation is the only example I didn't follow personally because it emerged a few months ago with the new government, but the government is clearly in favor, except that they realized that the kind of reform they initially proposed is by and large unenforceable. The public opinion is mostly uninterested in this. I mean, there is a very small number of riders. People are not really interested in the kind of contracts that they do have, as long as they provide to deliver the meal on time. Time being, no regulation has been introduced. I would say that no regulation will be introduced, but a negotiation was started to define a national contract for riders. In the Italian labor law, a national contract is binding for anybody, including those who do not sign it. It's basically a way to have something similar to minimum wage. And finally, with the Airbnb tax and web tax, again, the government was silently against. Everybody from within the Ministry of Economic Development and from within the Ministry of Economy would say this is crazy, it's impossible to enforce, and it's going to create us a number of problems. But nobody, almost nobody, went before a microphone to say this. And in this case, differently from the anti-platypus amendment, the public opinion was largely in favor of the tax. Why? Because, of course, the proponents were very, very good in addressing the tax in a way to let the online players pay, and in order to reduce taxes on offline players and on individuals. And, of course, this is quite a convincing argument before people who, generally speaking, do not have any knowledge about how tax law works internationally. So the two online taxes, one on home sharing platforms, and the other about all online service transactions were introduced, and we'll see that they are now legally challenged in court, and we'll see how it ends. But in this case, bootleggers and blacklists made the win. So, conclusion, 30 seconds. My conclusion is that the theory of bootleggers and blacklists still has something to say. It's still a useful tool to understand how regulatory changes are made, and which regulatory proposals are more likely to be introduced. One potential difference is that the lobbying power of big business is probably less important today, at least as long as digital economy is concerned, and its impact on the non-digital economy. Big business is probably less relevant than it was a few decades ago, but still, you can have bootleggers among smaller operators, which are no less bootleggers than with big business. And so my provisional conclusion is that the old saying is still true, that when the three biggest lies in history are the biggest lie, the check is on the map, second biggest lie, we are only friends, and first biggest lie, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Italy is waging a war against the sharing economy, and right now food delivery is the only thing surviving.
Yeah.
Okay. Is this working?
Yes.
Thank you very much to the Istituto Bruno Leoni and of the team for inviting me my first time in 12 years. I don't know what to think about why you've been waiting so much. Well, I have enjoyed a lot your paper. I recognize it's the first time I heard about bootleggers and Baptist theory. And now I can recognize, thinking of some regulation claims that are now in the newspapers in my own country, I can recognize both the bootleggers and the Baptist side. Besides taxis versus Uber, is universal, and Cabify and Cabify, hotels versus Airbnb, etc. In all these cases, as you explained, Baptists have an ideological or moral or religious interest in regulation, and they join forces with small businesses, big businesses, or in general some lobbies with vested interests in resisting competition, in this case from online platforms. And as I come from Spain, and I don't know if you know, but we are the champions resisting competition. Since the 19th century, we've been resisting competition with a great success, unfortunately for us. And following this idea that resisting competition is something that is not new at all, I think that the phenomenon we are living is only one side of the mercantilist economy in which we are living. We are not anymore in a capitalist economy, if we have ever lived in one. We are in a new mercantilist era where property rights are not completely respected, but only partially accepted. The market ought to be regulated, and people ask for these regulations. Many entrepreneurs collude with the state on a daily basis, and the state, the government, and governmental agencies. And nationalist economic policies are seen as a sort of patriotism, and so on and so far. So it's not really very different from what happened in the 17th century. The double face problem of regulation that you propose explain in a very simple and beautiful way why is it so difficult to fight in interventionist policies. Because whenever you show an economic reason, a data, an economic result, they offer a moral argument to the public. And then you have to choose between continuing to offer data to analyze what's going on in the real economy, in the people's real economy, or quit and start a discussion about moral or ideology. And then you know that they win the battle because people stop paying attention to real life and they are completely blind to the vested interests involved in regulation. There is no doubt about the importance of the development of information and communication technologies, the ICTs, and its application to industry, to small businesses, and to online platforms, and you propose several reasons, you expose a lot of reasons in defense of this new economy, and I think that are very sounding, and probably there are much more. But you know that as I was waiting for your article, I spent my time reading about digital regulation. I was reading very recent for regulation. And my first conclusion is that digital economy must be very, very important because they are spending a huge amount of money trying to agree about how and what to regulate. And it's very funny to check that the essence of digitalization is causing them so many troubles. I read a long, long document, 2008 document, from the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. They hold annually a symposium of global symposium of regulators. Only the name is creepy. And there, in this document, they stated the risk and challenges of the ICT sector and what they call these disruptive entities that are Netflix, Google, all the platforms you mentioned, Apple, Facebook, WhatsApp, Viber, Uber, and Airbnb. And they stress the importance of setting the right regulatory environment. One, to ensure that the consumers are happy and can use the full palette of new opportunities and services made available by all the greater choice of devices, online devices and applications. And then you can find all the arguments, the traditional arguments of the good labor side of regulation. They recognize, well, I think it's not the good labor, but the parties, these good intentions from the parties' side of regulation. They recognize the potential of the emerging technologies and the impact, positive and negative impact, that the regulatory framework may have in their success. But they, nevertheless, they encourage a regulatory paradigm with that has to follow several points. And it is a very long list, don't worry, I won't mention all of them, but let me, the first one is the impossible. It is a definition of what is impossible? This, the implementation of a regulatory framework through flexible light touch, multi-sectoral, forward-looking, neutral, and transparent policy and regulatory approach. I don't know any single case in the history of regulation where this happens, so it's impossible. But then, of course, they say that the regulatory framework has to address intellectual property rights, artificial intelligence, investment, job creation, cybersecurity, technological neutrality. They have to improve the economic growth, enhance citizens' life experience, create new business opportunities. Of course, they have to keep sufficient flexibility of rules, etc., to promote opportunities for youth, to nurture a community of entrepreneurs and mentors. What about women? We are not reflected here. It's the only thing. Women, disabled people, you know. So they are aware that they need an investment-friendly policy and regulatory framework, and to ensure the predictability and regulatory certainty that is needed to promote businesses so they are not stupid. But what I think that is more important is that they recognize the dangers. Because they realize that the app economy is inherently global, and this has an impact on regulation. And that they say that ideally a unified global approach to regulation is desirable, but is unlikely to be operative in the short or even medium term. Unified rules for facilitating infrastructure deployment, etc., can strongly contribute towards stimulating the development of app economy. And this is where I think that they are in trouble. They have a huge problem. Because they say that cooperation among all public authorities involved at the international, regional, and local level is key to rapid, smooth, and efficient implementation. And the problem is that, in my opinion, that those vested interests we've been talking about some years ago, and that are more or less hiding under good intention, morals, and ideology of the Baptist side of regulation, tend to emerge more the more locally the regulation is focused. And that this vested interest battle will prevent the digitalization success. This faith in the state's ability to defend your own good, the market performance, reminds me of one article I read last week at the Montreal Society meeting from Ed Stringham, the same that wrote the private governance that Philip mentioned in the previous session. Stringham's article name is The Fable of Leeches, the single most unrealistic positive assumption of most economies. And his question is, how reliable is government enforcement against online fraud? From this question, he concludes that markets emerge not because the private sector convinced governments to start enforcing contracts in them, but because parties relied on private governance to reduce problems and facilitate trade. And I think that is very important when we address the digitalization, innovation, and also what I think that is the real challenge in the near future, that is not digitalization or the digital economy, but the digital transformation. I think that if we have to challenge regulation, we have to address the digital transformation that consists not only in the deployment of some innovation, technological innovation, but, well, the example is the caterpillar and the butterfly. When the caterpillar began the transformation or suffered the transformation, it's not to slimming down in a faster or in a more efficient way, is to become something completely different. The meaning is to redefine your identity, to become a butterfly from the perspective of the firm. How? Well, you have to think strategy. I don't have time enough. I think that 1 minute. Well, who cares? We have a whole day to. You have to reframe innovation. Now the innovation is institutional innovation, and also you have to scale the edge. You have to find this small edge that maybe now is not offering or giving value to the firm, but maybe with this digital innovations could boost it and make a difference. And so you can transform the core of your business. So the real win in an exponential world is to find out how to transform into something that will keep transforming as the pace of change further accelerates. And I think that this is the key. The more radical and fast is the transformation, the more difficult it is to tax the activity of the firm. And that's why I think that we have to address not only these small changes and small regulations on platforms, Uber, Deliveroo, I also use all these platforms, but to address this radical transformation that I think is related with the first session about the Cypher Fund economy. Thank you.
I will restrain. Who's got the microphone? You can give it to Professor Fadi for the first part.
Thank you very much. I like this, this framework for thinking about regulation very much, but I do think there's an important difference between what's happening now, at least in Britain, and I think from what I've heard maybe in Italy as well, and this classic bootleggers and Baptist framework. So if you think to the original Baptists, they're a particular religious group arguing for restrictions in a particular market, the sale of alcohol. They wouldn't necessarily have objections to market freedoms in other sectors. What we have today is an organized ideological group, people on the far left of politics, the environmental movement, far left in general, who are opposed and make moral arguments against any kind of market liberalization, which then creates the opportunity for businesses that benefit from maintaining regulation to benefit from it. That's a very different situation, and I think it requires a different sort of response. To follow on from what Maria was talking about, it's no use making data-based arguments in a context like that. You actually need moral arguments, people to make a moral counter-argument against the moralistic anti-market arguments that are being made. And the tragedy is that in the liberal movement, broadly conceived, those arguments simply haven't been made. People are too concerned, in my view, actually, with consequentialist type of arguments, and they ought to make the moral argument. You know, who on earth has the right to stop people from doing a deal with Uber or Deliveroo or whatever else may be? Those arguments need to be made.
If you don't mind, I'd like to collect if there are more questions. Anybody else?
Thank you. So, do you think there is a difference when the innovation, let's say, is disruptive, directly disruptive of the regulation, as in the case of Uber, that is an innovation that tries to wipe out the taxi sector, which is heavily regulated, or when you have an innovation like, I think Airbnb is different because it is something which collects information about the market, which, let's say, is not regulated, but just taxi. So if you think it is important to distinguish in your framework these two different kinds of innovation. Thank you.
Another question?
Just following up to Marx's point, how do you explain in the Baptist and bootleggers framework the demand for food delivery regulation? Because it seems to me the amazing thing when it comes to food delivery regulation is that you have no market losers. So restaurants are happy with food delivery, consumers are happy with food delivery. Even people delivering food, with the exception of three ideologues, students, have had to do that. So how do you put that into your framework?
I will actually not resist anymore and also add my question. Something that you can also work out in this framework is to consider the regulators itself as Baptists. And since my day job is to be a supervisor of regulators, we see that one of the things that have been disrupted by technological innovation is not just business models, but also regulatory models. Like taxi licensing and unions were fought for a time where there was stronger informational asymmetry and much higher difficulties in matching requests. And these difficulties are being destroyed by technology. So it's the regulators itself, they need to find a new moral argument, new justification, as you effectively pointed out, like picking and choosing from a broad range of whatever kind of interest to be. So you don't need anymore or so much to have Baptists in the society. Your regular regulators will always enjoy to provide a good justification for more regulation. Any more?
I'm referring to the food delivery subject. In my opinion, instinctively, I would say that the bootleggers are the riders, and that the best effectives are the trade unions. It is true that who wears the dresses of whom is probably not so relevant because in the cooperative itself. And the interests are quite different, because what is the interest of the trade unions? The interest of the trade unions is to have more power generally, to occupy also that field. It's not an interest of monetary value, only of saying we don't want something unregulated.
Okay, Marx pointed out groups like environmental movements having like an ideological charge and themselves. Yet that's a distinctive fact of today's politics, of course. The same can be said to some extent with reference to, for example, many consumer associations or other peace in the world kind of movements. I would say that in a secular world, they are today's Baptists to some extent. To many other extents, Pope Francis is King Baptist.
That's a bit strong to say
when it comes to the general idea of where human interaction should be left to the individual freedom or to some sort of economic regulation. But I don't think that's per se an argument against the model. It's just that when you try to use this model, as well as any other model which was conceived in a not so distant past, we are talking about something that was proposed in 1983 and developed in the 90s, but ideologically and socially speaking, the 1980s are the Roman age. From this point of view, I think that the idea, the identification of who has today the moral high ground has changed, and to some extent some of the groups you mentioned do actually have the moral high ground, and environmental movement is of course a clear example of that. And in this framework, they are the Baptists. Alberto and Franco had a point on food delivery. I think that Franco actually answered Alberto. From my point of view, in the food delivery debate, the Riders Association, which were they had very little representativeness, but they were clearly the bootleggers. They were pursuing a personal interest in the sense that they wanted to have an employment contract and all the social protection which are granted to employees as opposed to independent workers. But the Baptists, in this case, the Baptists in this case were the trade union, the larger trade unions, who provided credibility of these very tiny groups before the general audience, the general public. It was the leaders of national trade unions who went to daily magazines saying this is a clear case of exploitation, this should not be possible, and so on and so forth. And it was there, them taking a stand, that made a very marginal issue a central political debate for some time in Italy. And clearly the interest of the trade unions was to reposition themselves in a world where they are losing influence and power. In the paper, I've got some data on the number of members that they've lost in the past 20 years, which is impressive. And this is partly due to the fact that the digitalization and the structural change which is happening is moving GDP and employment from the traditional manufacturing sector to service sectors like food delivery. And whereas trade unions are traditionally stronger and more representative in the manufacturing as opposed to the services sector. And so I think in this debate that the role of trade unions, which have no direct interest in food delivery per se, but have an interest in positioning themselves as a political stakeholder when you talk about economic sectors where they have basically little or no capability of being representative of real interests and real workers. And finally, Rosemary's point, I absolutely agree, very often it happens that the regulators themselves act as both parties and players. A regulator calling for more regulation is a Baptist to the extent that he has some greater credibility than because of his status before the general public, and it also acts as employers in the sense that it's basically advocating more powerful for itself. I've got a number of nice stories about this. About energy price regulation, where the greater advocate for regulation was the regulator itself. And it would be no surprise that a public agency which is supplying customers under the regulated tariff. So yes, that's absolutely it's something which is happening and which happens all the time.
Maria, yes, I want to say something about what Mark was saying. I think that we have to admit that we are living in a society where if you ask for no regulation or for increasing the regulation, then this position is morally acceptable. And the regulators have a moral superiority. So I think that maybe we shouldn't offer more moral arguments. Of course, we have. We have the best moral arguments, the best theories, since many centuries ago. But I think that what our society needs is facts. And what the new platforms, the new platforms economy, and especially this new digital transformation, etc., offers to people is a better life, is facts. The first time you taste or you see film in Netflix or ask for food, etc., or whatever, whenever you use this platform, then you discover a new world where things don't have to be regulated. And I think that this is the best argument we can offer. And on the other hand, only new generations with a different abilities, mind, imagination, etc., can help us to overcome our mindset, old mindsets. I don't know if we are able to offer a solution, but I think that we should offer more moral arguments.
Last
word.
Yeah, three points. Very quick. The first one on Maria's comment. I think an important argument against new regulation is that very often regulation prevents innovation, and we know that innovation in the long term generates social benefits for anybody. A few days ago, Nobel was awarded for Romer. One of Romer's achievements was to show that the benefits, the public benefits of innovation, so to speak, are far greater than the private benefits to innovators. And that's an important, a very important point. Second, Carlo's point about disruptive innovation versus incremental innovation, I think that has to do with the initial condition where the process happens. When you have disruptive innovation, very often bootleggers call for conserving old regulations, which were designed when disruptive innovation was not in place, and so very often which are incompatible with the innovations themselves. Whereas where you have incremental innovation, it's more likely that the bootleggers will call for new regulation to prevent or reduce its effect. And my third and last point, which has absolutely nothing to do with my paper, I would like to say that the paper, and I take the liberty of saying that this is here, is dedicated to the name of David Anderson, who is a very good friend of mine and good friend of the Instituto Corleone, who passed away a few days ago.